have synthetic occupants in these houses. And synthetic occupants are basically like robots, which will go around the house and do everything that real people would do. We see a lot of highly glazed flats in big cities where people are, it's so hot in there that they're having to install air conditioning, and we're seeing lots of excess summer deaths. In the Western world, we spend at least 90% of our time in buildings. If you're ill and vulnerable, probably up to 100% of your time. So the built environment, the spaces that we occupy, are one of the most important things for your health. So one of the things you'll do is you'll build a model of the house and test it to see whether or not it overheats. So for the UK, the overheating problem is severe. It's a problem that's going to be getting worse due to more frequent heat waves that last longer and are more intense. In 2022, we saw the first 40 degree heat in this country. So this is a problem that isn't going away unless we deal with it. So 3,000 people in quite a densely occupied space with no ventilation, and the air quality was really quite poor. And this actually led to the Scottish government preventing nightclubs from reopening at the end of 2021. So the research had big impact, but it was an interesting time.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Ben Roberts. Ben is a lecturer in building energy at Loughborough University. Ben, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Not at all. So I want to get one thing straight. I was reading your lecturer title and I realised that there's a particular intonation that might be needed, because you could be in a lecturer in building energy, as I sort of said, or in building energy. Right. And did I get it right?
It's building energy. You did get it right, yeah.
Good. I wanted to make sure that I got that clear. And I guess whichever one of those it was going to be would sort of tell people a little bit about what you do. So just to clarify things and to help our listeners and viewers, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So I'm a lecturer in building energy, so energy in buildings, and the energy use in buildings and the comfort of the people who live there. So to sum up my work, I like to say I do research on the indoor air that's either too hot, too dirty, or both. So it's looking at the way that we design and operate buildings to make sure that the temperatures inside are healthy, safe, and comfortable to occupy. And the air that we breathe is of an acceptable indoor air quality.
Very interesting. And that I can imagine already how that impacts on people's health on an everyday and a long-term basis. But before we get into and chat about that, what got you into this area? What made this part of the, your academic background, the thing you wanted to specify and go into?
Yeah, so many years ago, I did a geography degree originally, and I was doing work around measurement of the physical environment. And then I ended up doing a master's in energy policy. So then I had this energy policy angle and this measurement angle. And I tried to combine the two to come together to do this PhD, which is ultimately in building physics. So bringing together energy and measurement of buildings, houses, and the people in them. So that's really how I got to this stage. I came to Loughborough back in 2014 for a master's degree in energy and buildings, actually, so quite relevant. And then from 2015, started my PhD looking at overheating in the UK. And then from 2019, went on to various research roles, including my first project was all about smart meters and the way we can use smart meter data from houses to work out how much heat houses are losing. So this is a potentially much more accurate way of understanding how energy efficient the entire UK housing stock is. At the moment, we just use something called EPCs, Energy Performance Certificates. So if you ever rented or bought a house, you might have been given that by the estate agent.
Yeah,
or the letting
agent. I see them. There's different colours, is there?
Yes.
And there's different A to E.
A to G.
G. Yeah. I don't really know. There you go. And I just look at it and go, oh, well, it's one of them.
Yeah. So, but Did it influence the way you, when you chose a house to rent or buy, did you go, oh, I want a more efficient house?
Yeah, I definitely looked at it. But I must say, when I was looking at it as a lay person who doesn't know this area, I just thought, you know, how high or low is it? But if it was in the middle, I don't know if that's all right. You know, is it bad that it's in the middle? Does it need to be at the top end? So I don't know that sort of
thing. So that's really interesting. So you perhaps the way you interpret that isn't translating into how you feel at home in terms of your comfort and your sensation around the heat. So a poorly performing home, you might find you've got drafts and cold surfaces which make you feel quite cold. If you've ever been into a really high performing house, like a passive house, a really airtight, well insulated house, you'll feel just an instant sensation of comfort, and that's really good for your health and your well-being.
I never would have thought of that, but I can see that you're an expert in this area, but you're very passionate about it. I firstly love seeing the varied career that people have to get to this point. It adds different sort of sides to why they are where they are now and sort of different areas of expertise. But if you were to, you know, give a brief statement to sort of whet people's appetite, say why we're going to talk about, you know, what we're going to talk about today is so important to you and to our listeners, what would you say?
Well, we spend most of our time in buildings. In the global north, in the Western world, we spend at least 90% of our time in buildings. If you're ill and vulnerable, probably up to 100% of your time. So the built environment, the spaces that we occupy, are one of the most important things for your health, because that is what you're exposed to on a daily basis. So if you're living in a damp, moldy home and breathing in all those spores for 90% of your time, that's going to have a really bad influence on your health. If you're in an environment where the air quality is poor, you're exposed potentially pathogens in the air. And if you're living in a place that's too hot, for example, we see a lot of highly glazed flats in big cities where people are, it's so hot in there that they're having to install air conditioning, and we're seeing lots of excess summer deaths.
Well, I remember, I think it was about a year ago, maybe 2022 or early 2023, that there was a lot in the news about mold in properties, and there was a death related to that. That was, you know, I'm sure there are many more deaths related to that across the world, but it made quite a bit of prominence in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think that made people wake up a little bit. Did you see that at all? That there was just, you know, there was more clamour around that sort of area after that?
Yeah, so there was a very high profile case in London, but there's been lots of other cases since then. Certainly in the Building Energy Research Group, which is where I'm based, we're doing increasing amount of work and research on damp and mouldy homes, which often comes from poorly insulated homes, cold homes, but it's also the way we ventilate our homes and the way we operate them. So it's not only important to have a warm home, but also a well-ventilated home, because you need to get rid of the humidity in the air. So if you think about your daily activities, you're breathing out, so you're breathing out litres, a couple of litres a day of moisture into the air. You might wake up in the morning and have a shower, that releases a huge amount of humidity into the air, then you'll go down, boil the kettle, again, more water, then you'll cook your dinner at night, steaming, you're boiling your pasta. So we're just putting a ton of water vapour into the air. If we haven't got a well-insulated house, that water vapour finds its way onto the cold surfaces, usually walls or windows, and then you get mould growth. The way we combat that is, as I've said, ventilation. So you get that humid air out, replace it with drier, less humid air from outdoors, or we insulate our homes better to remove those cold surfaces. So really, it's a combination of those two things.
That's really interesting, and I now want to bring us to, you know, where we are currently, because for those who can see where we are or are listening to this podcast, we're in a different environment. We're not in the studio, we're not delivering this online, we're in person, but we're in a house in Loughborough in the East Midlands in the UK. Why are we in this house, Ben? And is this a good example of a good or a poorly put together house, ventilation wise or anything?
Well, this is an example of a very typical house for the UK. We've got two houses here. We're about 2 minutes walk from the university campus in the East Midlands. These are houses that are owned by the university and have been owned since about the 1970s. They are called the Loughborough Matched Pair Test Houses. So we have two houses side by side. They're typical 1930s semi-detached houses with a mirrored floor plan. So we have the two semi-detached houses here. Because they've been owned by the university for such a long time, they've been maintained in the same way. So if you think about, if you walk down the average street, someone will buy a house and make some renovations, and the house next door, someone will move into that and maybe do something different, put some more loft insulation, change the windows. These two houses have been identically maintained. They have the same amount of loft insulation, which is just standard up to building reg standards, the same type of windows, and we have blocked two of the windows. So in this house, both house faces south, but in this house, the west facing window, we've blocked up with some insulation. And in the house next door, which is the east house facing east, we've blocked up the east facing window. And this is to stop early morning sunlight coming through one house and heating one house up quicker, and afternoon sunlight coming into the other house and heating that. So we've done lots of tests on these houses to make sure that the indoor temperatures are identical or extremely similar under normal operations. And this then allows us to do various different types of comparison side-by-side tests. So for example, for my PhD, I was looking at overheating and ways we can prevent overheating and reduce indoor temperatures in summer. So in one house, we had some type of window opening strategy. And in the other house, we say had the windows closed. And because the houses were otherwise identical, we were able to directly compare the two sets of indoor temperatures to each other and attribute the window opening or not to that specific temperature. So it's a very standard, you've probably heard of paired testing. It's a very standard technique. So these houses are kind of halfway between real houses and halfway between a laboratory. You'll notice that they look a little bit empty.
We tried our best
with the furniture cobbled together, but otherwise these houses are completely empty. We don't have real people living in here. The problem with test houses and having real people in, you can't control what the people are doing. And people's behaviour, the way they open the windows, the way they use the heating systems, has a real influence on, for example, the energy use or the temperatures inside. So instead, we have synthetic occupants in these houses. And synthetic occupants are basically like robots, which will go around the house and do everything that real people would do. They'll open and close the windows, they'll open and close the doors, they'll use the curtains and the blinds, and they'll also produce heat. So right now, you're giving off about 100 watts of heat. They'll replicate that amount of heat. And then if you're in your real home, you'd go and cook your dinner and put your oven on. They'll also be able to replicate the same amount of heat that comes out of an oven or a TV or a laptop. And what this allows us to do is precisely control what our occupants are doing. And then that helps us to do these paired tests because we can have the same type of occupancy in both houses, but change one thing. So we might change, as I've said before, the window opening strategy, or we might have someone who uses the heating more in one house or the other and compare the energy use.
That's really, I mean, there's a lot that I would love to go into if we had 4 hours of this, because this is not an area I have any knowledge on at all. So I want to know, what did you find? What did you look into specifically? What did you find? And then how applicable do you think this actually is to everyone's daily life? Because we're not robots, we do respire, and we do that at rates that we can't control in a large way anyway. How applicable do you think that actually is your results to everyday living situations for people in the UK?
Yeah, so my PhD research was based in these houses. And one of the things I was trying to do was find out if we could keep houses cool with just using windows and internal shading, because the vast majority of houses have windows and external shading. So can we keep those houses cool without using air conditioning and without having to make expensive retrofits? And what I found was, if you open the windows according to a particular strategy, you can keep the maximum temperature down by about 2 degrees. If you night ventilate, you can go down to about 3 or 4 degrees compared to doing nothing. So night ventilation, where you open your windows at night and make use of that cool night air to flush out the heat of the day from the house, that was one of the best things you could do. Quite interestingly, what I found, and which contrasts with what a lot of the recommendations from the heatwave guidance is that closing the curtains on the south side of the house didn't actually reduce the indoor temperature by much, by about half a degree on average. It's partly because in these houses we've got very dark grey curtains, and so the sun comes through the windows and then is absorbed by the curtains, and then it's in the room at that point. The other things that the curtains were doing were they were blocking the ventilation through the windows. So if you think about most people when they go to bed at night, close the curtains or close the blinds. And as I've said, the best thing you can do is night ventilate, get as much air going through your house as possible. But I did some tracer gas tests to work out the ventilation rates. So I filled the room with carbon dioxide, and then watched how the carbon dioxide level decreased over time. From that, I was able to work out the ventilation rate. And I found in the house with the curtains open compared to the house with the curtains closed, the ventilation rate was 20% higher when the curtains were open. So we can get a much higher ventilation rate. So what I'm leaning towards from the end of my PhD was that we can't keep our houses cool in heat waves just using windows and curtains. So we need to do something more. And also we need to look at the ways that we can night ventilate separately from the curtains. So that might be some kind of secure night ventilation opening. So you might have a separate door next to your window, which is it's light attenuated, noise attenuated. So it blocks traffic noise and it blocks the light coming through, but it still allows the air to pass through. And the other thing I'm looking at in some research I've just got funding for is external shading systems. And external shading systems are likely to be much more effective on these houses because they're blocking the sun before it gets through your windows and before it gets into your house. Unfortunately, in the UK, you don't see a lot of external shading systems on houses, partly because our windows open outwards. So that often, if you think about Mediterranean shutters, they close and you can't then open your windows. So we might need to turn all our windows into inward opening ones. Also, the research is also going to look at how acceptable external shading is to people. Are people willing to have external shading systems on their houses? Are they a bit ugly? So on my house, I've fitted a temporary shade sail, which you can buy out back of my house. You know, I'm interested in this kind of thing. I think it's quite interesting. But my other half thinks it looks horrible and is constantly saying, take that thing down, even though it does make a huge difference to the thermal comfort of the house and it keeps it much cooler.
So you're thinking in that regard, something like an awning, you know, that's a sort of shading, or it, just in thinking of practical terms that people could do now, if they have like an outside large umbrella that goes over a table normally, yeah, they could put that up in an area before an outside window where the main light comes in.
Absolutely, sort of, yeah. That's a really simple thing you can do. I've even seen people in very hot flats in London as a temporary measure putting tin foil on their windows to try and stop the sun getting in.
On the outside? Or
on the outside, yeah. So you sort of have to lean out, which is potentially a bit dangerous.
Yeah, I was thinking about the safety about that, you know, the recommendation about the night ventilation. A lot of the, you know, people, when they leave their house, so when it's not occupied, they'll shut the windows, shut the doors, lock it all for safety. Similarly, at night, I think quite a lot of people also lock the front door and they shut the windows because they're not conscious and they're not going to be available if someone comes in or if there's any, you know, intrusion or whatever. So, you know, is that a safe thing for people to do, or does it depend on the, you know, the type of windows, the type of house, the type of location that you're in? Mm-hmm. And how do you help people where it's not safe to open a window?
Yes, so there's a ton of research which has shown that people don't like opening their windows at night, especially in cities. So it's not only the security issue, which is one factor, it's also the noise issue and potentially the pollution issue. So if you're living by a big road, you get lots of pollution. So in these houses, I did a number of night ventilation tests. Because they were unoccupied, I didn't have to worry really about anyone burgling the place because there was nothing in here to steal. But so one of the tests I did was I just had the bedroom windows open at night. Another type of test I did, I had some ground floor windows and the bedroom windows open at night. Now, when you open a ground floor window at night alongside the bedroom windows, it's much better for cooling because you get this stack ventilation. So warm air rises through the house and with it is drawing in cooler air from below. Whereas if you've just got the top set of windows open, you're relying on a smaller amount of stack ventilation and cross ventilation from the wind. So if you can, try and build in some kind of secure night ventilation downstairs. So a grilled shutter or maybe even a window with security bars on, which you often see in places like in the Mediterranean. That may be the direction of travel for us. Some kind of window which you feel comfortable to leave open at night, which blocks the light, which blocks the sound, and potentially even blocks the insects from coming in as well.
To me, it sounds like we need to move to because of the way the UK climate is changing, and we're having, like last summer in 2022, we had the roaring heat where it was up to 30, 40 degrees. Yeah. It feels like landlords should be asked to provide a ventilation map for their anything that they're renting out to people, so that in that particular location, with that particular installation, the way the building is put together, as a tenant how the best way to get ventilation is for the building. I would love that as a renter.
Yeah, I think, so you mentioned 2022, we had about 3,000 excess summer deaths, so this is like a really important issue. In terms of how we ventilate our houses, my PhD started to sort of give indications of what you should do in terms of which windows you should open and when. But certainly some kind of, part of your welcome pack when you move in. Maybe alongside you get given an EPC to say your house is this energy efficient. You also get and this is how you should ventilate to stop summertime overheating, but also to protect against wintertime damp and mould. You mentioned existing homes. For new build homes, since 2022 in England, all homes now have to undergo an overheating risk assessment before they're built. So one of the things you'll do is you'll build a model of the house and test it to see whether or not it overheats. And if the model says it does, you then have to make modifications to the design. So I think potentially, and I can talk more about these models because I did another piece of work which showed about how accurate they were, but potentially in future, we should start seeing housing design move towards these better solutions in terms of overheating mitigation. So either better ventilation, larger ventilation openings, secure night ventilation, and external shading.
That's really interesting. I know that in public health more broadly, it's important to amend the systems in place so that people, individuals, are less likely to have to be the ones that make those changes. So it's easier in terms of behavioural science, but also you can do things more systemically, as you said, sort of with the new housing regulation coming in. But I mean, you were talking about the Mediterranean, how they do things differently. You mentioned just England. So abroad, is there very different sort of ways that people manage heat that we're just, they say in the UK, if it has a little bit of snow, everything grinds to a halt in the UK. Is it very different abroad in different places?
So there's more of a cultural knowledge around how you adapt to heat in hotter parts of the world. I've often heard people say, well, I don't know how to operate my house in the summer. I don't know what I'm doing. You will often see people with their windows open on a really hot day. You walk around a Mediterranean country, you'll see the windows will be closed on a hot day. And that's because when the outdoor temperature is higher than indoors, you want to keep the building sealed up and then reopen it at night when the outdoor temperature is cooler. So really with passive cooling, so cooling without using air conditioning, we're relying on the outdoor temperature to cool our houses. So in an older house like this, which has got quite thick walls, you can use that night ventilation to cool the walls down at night. They hold that coof, and then in the day you shut your windows up and you've almost got like a cool battery in your house. And then you'll see a lot of Mediterranean countries, they have big stone walls which store that cool from the night. They close their windows and then reopen them at night. So I think there's certainly a lot of scope for better education around how we in England and the UK operate our homes. And I really like what you said about, people should be not involved in the process of keeping their houses cool. So not relying on people to operate their windows and blinds. That's what I like about external shading, because external shading just sits there and it stops the sun from coming in and keeps your house cool. I think that's the best solution in my mind.
Yeah, you can always have it. You could have it as a timer that goes where, you know, when the different season and where the sun is, and you know, it could be set to that. This is, you know, me not knowing this area but thinking outside the box about, you know, I think you've sold it to me. That
sounds well, it's like even simpler than a timer. You can calculate the length of the external shade, and in the summer when the sun's very high, it will hit the external shading. In the winter, when the sun's lower, it will come below the shading, so you don't even have to adjust it. Mm. So it's as simple as that, but I just don't know if people are going to be accepting of having external shades stuck to the outside of the house. If you've got a really nice, you know, architecturally, like Victorian or a 1930s semi-house, would you want an external shade system on your house?
I think if it looked all right, and it blended in with the aesthetic. You know, when you see an extension and sometimes that, you know, they have to blend in with the original house. If you had that with a sort of outside shading, then I'm sure it could be okay. People adapt, don't they? We see different things. We see energy panels on roofs and things like that. I think what you mentioned about the culture sort of needing to change about this, and both in the policy but also in the public domain, is really, really important. It's really hard to change a culture, though. Mm-hmm. And I know you've done a lot of work in Africa, mm-hmm. Looking at a similar sort of area, where I can imagine, because of the fact that the heat, extreme heating, has been a more prevalent issue to deal with over a longer period of time, that the culture's very different. Have you found that out there?
Yes. So there's certain behaviours that people do to keep themselves cool. One of the things I've observed, and through speaking to people, is that so I work in Ghana quite a lot, and they have these compound houses, which are lots of small rooms around a central courtyard, and they'll use different rooms at different times of the day depending on where the sun is, and you always want to be sitting in the coolest spot. So that's one of the in terms of the good building design. Culturally, people's sleep patterns are quite different from the UK. So some of the research I've done in Ghana was looking at, we asked people to fill out a time diary, so what they were doing at specific times of the day. And we often saw people got up very early in the morning, around 4 o'clock, conducted maybe 3 or 4 hours of activities. Maybe they'd go and do some work, or they'd do some housework. And then when the heat of the day came, they'd go to sleep. And then they'd wake up again in the later evening and work again in the cooler part of the day. So there's adaptations which perhaps the rigid society in the UK wouldn't be accepting of, that in terms of, you know, you need to be at work at this time and school at this time. The other thing I've seen people do is wet sheets, and put wet sheets over their body and then sit in front of a fan, and then they rely on the fan to evaporate the water off the sheet and cool them down that way. So,
interesting. And why don't we just use air conditioning, though? I mean, because that could be something that's just built into properties, that people don't have to turn on themselves. It comes on when it's related to the temperature, or, you know, in the room, or whatever it is. So whether it's the UK or whether it's in Ghana, can't we just use air conditioning everywhere instead of the indoor and external shading that you mentioned?
It'd be a lot simpler, wouldn't it?
To my mind.
My job would be done. So air conditioning...
out of a job.
Air conditioning would solve all the problems to do with extreme heat, because air conditioning is a proven technological solution to cool the indoor environment. There's a number of problems. It uses a lot of electricity. So we're trying to decarbonize our electricity system globally. So by doing that, we also need to reduce the demand on electricity consumption. Where I work in Ghana, there's in the communities I work in, there's frequent power cuts. So we can't rely on air conditioning to provide that cooling, because it doesn't work when there's no power. In terms of health and well-being, I don't particularly like being in air-conditioned environments. One of the things they do is they dehumidify the air. And so you often get very dry eyes and dry skins, and it dries out the mucous membranes. And you find that your tolerance of variations in temperatures is decreased in an air-conditioned environment. So when people leave that environment, they're less accepting of higher temperatures, and then they were going to install air conditioning somewhere else, and it's just a knock-on effect. So We need to really avoid air conditioning if possible. There's some other issues around the air quality that comes with air conditioning. So I've done a lot of work in hospitals in Ghana, and I was looking at both the combination of extreme heat and indoor air quality. And in many of the wards, they have retrofitted air conditioning systems. And so these are recirculating air conditioning systems, which take the air from the room, run it through the air conditioning system, and pump the same air back into the room. They're not introducing any fresh air. So the nurses and the ward staff were closing all the windows and turned the air conditioning on. And people were reporting, "I feel very comfortable. I'm nice and cool. It's not too hot in here now." As part of my research, when I'd visited these hospitals, I noticed that the air felt very stuffy in these air-conditioned rooms. So I installed carbon dioxide sensors. So carbon dioxide is something that people breathe out, and you can measure the carbon dioxide concentration as a proxy for exhaled breath and for ventilation. And I compared in four different hospitals in both Accra in the south of Ghana and Tamale in the north of Ghana. I compared the air quality in the air-conditioned wards and the naturally ventilated wards. And I found the air quality was much poorer in the air-conditioned wards compared to the naturally ventilated wards. So we now have this trade-off between thermal comfort, which is very important for health, and air quality. And you think in a hospital, this is an environment where people have potentially got some kind of illness, a respiratory illness. They're coughing up and aerosols are coming out of their mouth, floating around this poorly ventilated environment, not being removed by the ventilation. Other people in the hospital wards are then breathing in these potentially virus-laden aerosols and becoming infected themselves. So there's lots of research on nosocomial infections, so hospital-acquired infections. Sometimes people will go into a hospital with one type of illness, and while they're there, in potentially a poorly ventilated environment, acquire a respiratory infection. So this is a real problem for the health and well-being in this kind of environment.
Yeah, I can see that. The thing that strikes me about a lot of your work is that you could see it as, you know, an adaptation to a house. But I think, you know, one of the things that I see is it's heavily related to policy more broadly as to how you create a type of public service in that way for optimizing people's health. And, you know, people might not naturally think that the building's architecture and the way that it's put together would feed into that sort of a policy discussion. Do you find that you're able to easily get into policy conversations or, you know, people in your area about these areas? Or has the world not woken up enough yet to people with your expertise actually impacting health-based research broadly across whichever country it is?
I think people have definitely woken up, and the policy angle is definitely there. The issue is that buildings are around for a long time. If you look at the UK housing stock, some of it has been around for 200 years. In fact, we have the oldest housing stock in Europe, in the UK. So making changes now to very old buildings can be quite difficult. And the retrofit process is also very expensive. So modifying buildings to cope with extreme heat or to be better insulated comes with all these issues. No matter the government policy, if you're trying to get someone to install loft insulation and you're throwing a grant at them, the government-funded grant, they may still say, "Oh, my loft's full of boxes. I've got all my Christmas decorations up there and I can't be bothered to move them. So I won't bother," even though they've got this government policy around it. So I think based on my experience, based in UK policy and in policy in Ghana, I've done a lot of work with the Ghana Health Service. They're very receptive to the research that we've been doing, but things just take a long time to implement.
Yeah, that's the case with a lot of policy, isn't it? It does take a long time to implement. But then also you've got the in the UK, especially, as you said, the age of a lot of our properties and, you know, the wish to be sustainable with, you know, how we're putting things together. And, you know, that's with new houses. But do we take down old buildings and reconstruct them? And how, you know, sustainable is that? But not only have you got the age-old problems where things go slowly or there's very static, you know, old houses, then we've come up with, you know, a few years ago we had a global pandemic that no one predicted, and that was a few years snapshot, and then at the moment we're out of the perils of that in its acute form. So I can see that's another area, like COVID-19, that must have changed the way that you had to try to think about buildings, or maybe not you, because you may have been able to predict the problems that we had, but for people in policy areas,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah. But I think it did change, it certainly changed my research focus. I'd been very focused on heat and reducing heat and using ventilation to reduce that heat. But then it moved me into this thinking about air quality and the interplay between air quality and heat. And I've mentioned the work in the Ghanaian hospitals, but also my work in the UK. So for a period of about 2 years, I was pretty much just focused on air quality around the COVID-19 pandemic. There was lots of work going on around air quality in buildings. So one of the projects I worked on was, it was called the Events Research Programme. So this was a government-led project to reopen cultural venues. So things like sports stadiums, large nightclubs, theatres, and we did monitoring of the indoor air quality in all these types of venues, and we found that, to be honest, most of the places had an acceptable indoor air quality. Most of the buildings with a properly designed ventilation system, be that a natural ventilation system or a mechanical ventilation system, actually were able to cope. The issue was some of the older buildings which hadn't, the ventilation system hadn't been well thought out. So for example, I monitored the first ever nightclub event to reopen post-pandemic, and it was held in an old warehouse, an old Victorian warehouse, which had no ventilation system, because why would you? But then you go and shove 3,000 people into this warehouse, and that suddenly causes problems for the air quality, funnily enough. So we went round and we did a ventilation assessment, and we saw these huge doors, warehouse doors, and we said, oh, this will be fine, there's plenty of ventilation coming in and out of here. And then the event kicked off, and they closed the doors halfway and put plastic butcher's screens in front of the door to block the sound, because the neighbours had been complaining with the noise. But of course, this blocked the ventilation as well. So 3,000 people in quite a densely occupied space with no ventilation, and the air quality was really quite poor. And this actually led to the Scottish Government preventing nightclubs from reopening at the end of 2021. So the research had big impact. It was an interesting time.
I'm sure it can be, a lot of research is extrapolated and taken to mean something or generalised where it might not be. And I think what you've made me, you know, think about there is how difficult it is. And I'm not sympathising for the difficulties and some of the things we could have done better in the pandemic, especially preparing policy-wise. But the difficulty associated with providing a blanket statement about what people can do, whether that's businesses, individuals, public services, when in your area, the buildings, even if they're the same square footage, and maybe even the same height, mm-hmm. the materials that they're made of will actually influence the air quality in this situation. And so saying, you know, a venue with capacity of 3,000 people can be opened now, you're saying then that's too generalised, because it will depend.
Exactly, too generalised. And we should have been able to say a venue with this capacity, with this type of ventilation system, or this number of air changes per hour in terms of ventilation. It should have been a bit more nuanced and a bit more specific, I think.
And then you can get into the conversation about, should the government be the ones that support the change of those buildings to enable them to open, especially when some people might be smaller business owners where they might not have been able to invest that money, and then they can't open and then they don't have their livelihood.
Exactly, yeah. But I suppose it comes down to the licensing. So venues have to go through a number of licensing requirements to do with fire safety and escape routes. Perhaps it needs to have a ventilation licensing bit tagged on as well.
There's a lot that we could go into in loads of detail, but what do you think needs to be explored in this area now? What are you doing, and where do you need to go with this sort of work?
So for the UK, the overheating problem is severe. It's a problem that's going to be getting worse due to more frequent heat waves that last longer and are more intense. You know, in 2022, we saw the first 40 degree heat in this country. So this is a problem that isn't going away unless we deal with it. So I mentioned the government building regulations on overheating. All new homes have to have a model built of them. Some of the work that I uncovered in my PhD and subsequently has shown that actually the models that we're using, there's a certain amount of uncertainty. So they're perhaps not as reliable at predicting overheating as we'd like or need. So one of the things we've found is that they overpredict the temperatures in the day. So they say actually it's hotter than it is in reality during the day. And at night they say it's cooler than it is in reality in buildings. So this is a problem because it means that perhaps we're not designing buildings with sufficient amounts of night ventilation. So my work going forward, and it's being done by many others, is to improve the reliability of these models. And it should be very easy to integrate into the government policy. And I think that will enable us to build a more resilient housing stock that can cope with overheating, not just now, but in 2050 when the climate's going to be significantly warmer.
And where can people find out more about you, you know, to see what you're doing with your research and everything?
Well, I have on the university website, for one, I've got my profile on there. I occasionally post papers to Twitter.
Yeah.
LinkedIn, if you'd like to have a look. They're probably the best places.
Brilliant. And we like to have a standard question that we ask people on this podcast. About if you were to sell your area of academic expertise or your area of interest to the next generation of curious minds, what would you say?
I think it would come back to this, the fact that people spend most of their time in buildings. So our building design and the way we design and operate buildings is crucial to the health and well-being of people. So if you want to influence people's health, design better buildings.
and hopefully people will get into this area more. We see that younger generations are, you know, very keenly aware of the climate changes that are coming and that we experience now. And I think maybe helping them to marry up that building design and energy for air quality, etc., can play to that sort of a drive. You know, it's a really key link. So maybe should they link that earlier at school or anything, at DT classes? Or?
Yeah, maybe, because it wasn't until I came to probably my master's degree that I started linking the building and the energy up together. So if we can get into schools, into science classes, or even perhaps integrate into geography classes, looking at the way different climates and people build buildings in different parts of the world. I think that'd be a really interesting thing to do.
Well, this episode has been really fascinating for me. I know that the listeners and watchers will find it interesting too. So thanks so much for coming on the show today, Ben.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Not at all. And thanks very much for tuning into the episode. If you've liked what we talked about today, feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also tune into our other podcast, Experts in Sport, and you can find the link to that in the show notes. So that just leaves me to say thanks very much for tuning in again, and hopefully we'll see you for another health-related discussion in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.